Good afternoon to the faithful ones that have remained here to the last session. We promise to make that interesting and entertaining. I'm George Valmahos from the Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School here in Boston. We have the honor and the pleasure to host all of you in Boston, and unfortunately the weather turned out miserable today. Until today it was delightful. I hope that it will be better again and you'll have a chance to not only come and get educated, but also enjoy this beautiful city. I have called a panel of experts, and I am not minimizing the word experts, because experts they are. They are people who are not just senior in terms of knowledge and read the literature and participate in academic endeavors, but are there also in the trenches. They take call regular. They see these patients that we're about to discuss. They don't know any of them right now, and I know that they are shivering. They're trembling. In order of appearance here, Dr. Sailant, actually I have the unique privilege of presenting Noelle Sailant, who is one of my partners, and she's the only one who really knows all the cases. The others, they don't know that I've told her about all the cases. Dr. Alam is the chief of the entire section of surgery at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Deepika Nehra, Dr. Nehra, she's in a trauma and acute care surgeon at the Brigham, at our sister institution across town. Dr. Matt Martin is a very well-known and well-spoken trauma surgeon who now is the new chief of trauma at Scripps Mercy Hospital. He just relocated from Washington State to California. And Dr. Dante Ye is also a trauma and acute care surgeon at the University of Miami, and he knows Boston very well because he's been at Mass General Hospital. With that short introduction, I will let the cases roll. We will have a number of emergency surgery cases. All of them are controversial. There's no right or wrong answers. I made the point to go to different sessions at the college to see what other experts say about this type of cases. So, you know, you hear all sorts of opinions, and I would encourage you to take part into this discussion and to make it also very entertaining for us, and come to the microphone and say that we are wrong or you have another way of doing things. None of us has any disclosures that are related to the content of the cases that we will present. And this is a 59-year-old retired teacher. In the ER of your hospital, and I know that we have a lot of physicians here who are from community or from rural hospitals, but all of you are in academic centers, so let's play that scenario for now. This patient came with a large amount of blood per rectum in your ER. The blood pressure was 90 over 60 millimeters of mercury. The heart rate was 110. The patient was fully awake and alert, and he was literally lying on the bed in a pool of blood behind his rectum. He's got a history of coronary artery disease with stents type 2 that he received 8 years ago, but since then, he's doing reasonably well. So I would like for you to tell me first what type of resuscitation we would do. Would you give crystalloids? Would you give colloids? Would you give any other type of magic water? Would you give blood with or without FFP, and on what ratio, and what goal of hemoglobin would you target? And I will start right next to me with Dr. Sailant.
So this gentleman, I think, clearly is presenting with hemorrhagic shock, so I'm in favor of starting with blood, and I like to resuscitate even in the emergency general surgery patient population at a 1-to-2 type of ratio. The goal of the hemoglobin, I think, is irrelevant because we're in the early part of his resuscitation, so we're truly just trying to keep him in the 90s and just allow him, as he's actively extravasating blood on our exam, just to stay at that level until we can either figure out where he's bleeding from or get definitive control.
Okay, so blood for Noel, and with a blood pressure of 90 systolic as a target. Dr. Alam.
Well, 90 systolic is not bad. You know, the concerning thing is this guy is old as opposed to a young trauma patient who
tolerates... old? 59?
You know, I'm in 50, so I can say old, right?
He just insulted about, you know, three quarters of the audience.
Let's say he's a middle-aged guy with two coronary stents. How about that?
Okay.
Two coronary stents. He doesn't have the best heart. I don't know. Usually coronary artery disease, carotid disease go hand in hand. So, you know, moderate amount of hypotension as long as he's comfortable, he's mentating, he's not looking diaphoretic. I'm okay with the pressure of about systolic of about 90. I would also send blood type and cross-match to the blood bank. I would have a very low threshold for activating the massive transfusion protocol if he shows signs of ongoing bleeding. This may have bled and stopped, or it may be bleeding. If this patient is bleeding, I would also activate the massive transfusion protocol.
Deepika, the first two tend to pontificate like real professors that they are. Would you please tell me, in the emergency room, when there is a venous access on this patient, whether you will give any crystalloid or not, and if yes, how much?
So first of all, he's definitely old.
Huh?
First of all, he's definitely old. Second.
Okay.
I would get good access, good large bore access. I try to stay away from crystalloids for patients in hemorrhagic shock, unless I feel like I really need something to try to increase their perfusing pressure while I'm waiting for blood. So I also would go with blood first. I wouldn't activate an MTP or a massive transfusion protocol up front in this patient, but if it looked like I was heading towards needing more than 10 units in the first 24 hours and just really having to give several units of blood, I would move towards a more balanced resuscitation with an MTP. But I would try to stay away from crystalloid up front. I
mean, you wouldn't give any crystalloid.
I think George is trying to trap you into the crystalloid. So let me just say, like, crystalloids are good for really two things, diarrheal disease and for boiling pasta. Short of that,
nothing else.
Nothing else.
Okay, Dr. Martin, in San Diego County.
Yeah, I agree with everything that's just been said, although I don't think I would jump right to giving a lot of blood. I mean, there's a systolic 90 and they're in shock, and then there's a systolic 90 and they're smiling at you and clearly perfusing everything. So I would sort them out into which one of those he is. I would get a stat set of labs, you know, including a hemoglobin, and there's no goal hemoglobin in this early phase. It's goal perfusion. And then you're just really trying to sort out, is this guy bleeding fast, actively bleeding? Does it look like he bled and he stopped? Because you can still have a lot of clot and they've stopped bleeding. So it's really sorting them into one of those two categories.
You're right. There's so many unknowns. Dr. Ye, the more we go to the south, the wiser we become.
And how did he retire at 59? That's the one thing I want to know.
So I agree with most of what was said on this panel so far, with the exception that I would not be so quick to activate the massive transfusion protocol, because... So the one component I would be really interested in is the platelets. This guy has coronary stents. He's most likely on antiplatelet agents. If this is an academic institution, you may or may not have access to some sort of advanced monitoring like TEG or platelet function assay. If not, I would probably start with platelets, but I would not activate the massive transfusion. We actually, before I left Mass General, if you remember, we did a study looking at massive transfusional activations at the Mass General. And in fact, a lot of our practice has been extrapolated for trauma. This is not a trauma patient. This is an EGS patient, and none of those protocols or mass transfusion has been validated in this population.
That's a very interesting concept, because you see, these are dedicated trauma surgeons after all. And immediately, the way they think is that, exactly like somebody who's shot in the inferior vena cava, this patient who's bleeding from the rectum should be managed more or less with the same protocol, which is, I don't give too much crystalloid, I think of blood early, and I keep the blood pressure low. And this is not how most general surgeons think. Noel, one last comment you wanted?
Well, I just was going to respond that I think that there hasn't been great studies in the emergency general population and in older patient populations. And, you know, if you look at the data, and some of that has been done previously at MGH, it's really hard to see how people transfuse, because you can't separate out people that have coagulopathy, which is important to understand in this gentleman.
You heard, obviously, no consideration of colloid, and let's put that to rest. This is the SAFE trial, published New England Journal of Medicine 14 years ago, on 7,000 ICU patients who were randomized to saline versus albumin, and you see that the survival curves are identical. This is the study, among many others, that have put the issue of colloids at rest. So if you ever think in colloid for a cystation, smaller volume, this, that, the other, albumin, just take it out of your mind. And this is a very important study. I asked the podium about a blood transfusion target. And again, in trauma, we have some certain ways of reacting to bleeding. But here is one seminal study published only 5 years ago at the New England Journal of Medicine with nearly 1,000 patients who were randomized after upper GI bleeding, not lower GI bleeding, upper GI bleeding, to either a liberal transfusion target, maintain the hemoglobin at 9 versus those at 7. Those who had the liberal strategy had worse survival. This is the same graph blown up again, starting at 9 instead of 0 survival, so that you can see the difference, you can appreciate the difference better, and you see that with the liberal strategy, the mortality was worse. So, you really want to keep this resuscitation low.
No, yeah. Just sort of to clarify that, these are patients with upper GI bleed who actually had stopped bleeding by that time. So we're not talking about patients who are actively bleeding and hypotensive and in shock. And I think this gives a very clear message that once somebody's bled and they're not hypotensive, they're not in shock, you're then treating a number. Now, a lot of these patients have cirrhosis, they have bad hearts, they are have varices, and giving them excessive amount of transfusion clearly has a downside. But these are not actively bleeding patients.
And this is about our patient now who had the large bore peripheral IVs and received some cautious administration of crystalloids to a blood pressure target that it was relatively low. The hemoglobin was measured was 8, so no blood transfusion, although everybody was ready to give blood if needed. And I would like, starting from Dr. Ye, to tell me about the next exams. Obviously, clinical exam, don't tell me, Dante, that I'm going to palpate his abdomen and listen to his chest. But nasogastric tube, is that any important? Any other acute intervention, what would you like to do?
So I think in this case, it's important for the surgeon to do a rectal exam to see if the source of this bright red blood per bleeding is something that's accessible and close by, like a bleeding hemorrhoid. It's unlikely, but you don't want to be that surgeon who missed it, right? So in addition to all that usual third-year medical student stuff, I would personally, examine the rectum myself, the anus, and just make sure that there isn't some big thing right there. Regarding the nasogastric tube, I actually, my wife is an emergency physician. There's a lot, emergency medicine. There's a lot of literature in their, wheelhouse, which says that a nasogastric tube may not be as high yield as we in surgery tend to think.
Well, let me, before you answer that, let me go down the panel and tell me.
To rule out an upper. That's what I mean.
Matt, would you place a nasogastric tube, which is the absolute torture, to this patient who's bleeding from below?
No.
Yes or no?
No.
Deepika?
In this patient, the way he is right now, no.
This patient is bleeding from below. Would you torture him with a nasogastric tube?
No.
No. Hassan?
No, and it's until I'm thinking about something, you're holding back something, which is entirely possible, but if it looks like old blood per rectum and he's got no history of peptic ulcer disease, man, I would not. I would not torture the patient.
Yeah, this was an same answer for a no. And Noel?
I actually might put an NG tube in, actually, because I don't know if it's an upper or lower. I agree that it's not always helpful, but if it's positive, that actually potentially helps me realize that it's an upper GI bleed, then I'm much more worried. The other thing that we haven't really gotten...
Can I see the audience? Can I poll the audience? Raise your hands if you would put a nasogastric tube.
Wow.
And not allowing non-deciding votes... Can you raise your hands if you would not put a nasogastric tube? Wow, you're almost split.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry, Noel.
But I need more history.
Oh, okay.
I
but
feel
you
like
need
I
more
need to
history.
Understand what else
okay.
is wrong with
you. Okay, so Dante, can you complete what you were saying about the nasogastric tube?
For lower GI bleeding, depending on where you read, you can hear an incidence as high as like 15% of these patients actually have an upper GI. And I think that's where a lot of our dogma comes from. If it's such a high percentage, you don't want to miss it and go chasing the wrong, going in the wrong hole, right? Chasing after the wrong source of bleeding. So That's sort of where I'm it's a toss up. I'd want to find out, you know, what's the history? Are you on PPIs? All that, you know, other stuff. But I probably would not put an NG tube.
So as this slide shows, number one, in terms of intervention, I would think that at the beginning you can be patient because 80% of lower GI bleeds cease spontaneously. You don't really need to rush to an intervention unless if you have persistent hypotension shock. It is very important that 10% of the cases with acute lower GI bleed come from upper GI sources. We have a patient that I very vividly remember who expired because we were looking and looking and looking at the lower GI tract, but this patient was bleeding from the duodenum and he just wasn't vomiting blood. He was just passing massive amounts of blood below. I learned a lesson then. And of course, as it mentioned, do not forget a rectal exam because it is embarrassing to start trying colonoscopies and angiographies and what have you, only to find that there is a hemorrhoid or a rectal cancer there. So in the ICU, this patient was fine for 3 hours. But then new blood from the rectum, the blood pressure dipped to a 70 over 50. The hemoglobin now is 6.5, and we immediately started transfusion. And he was again successfully resuscitated. What would you do, Dr. Nera?
I would set this guy up for a colonoscopy to take a look for a lower GI.
So you have these options, colonoscopy right now, colonoscopy later.
I mean, he's stabilized, correct? You said you resuscitated him and his blood pressure has improved at this point?
Yes, yeah. Yes, this young man improved.
It's very, very young man. So I would actually set him up for a colonoscopy, not like right this minute, but I'd be arranging to do that within the next couple of
weeks. Let me just take an opposing view on the colonoscopy. In an unprepped bowel with a lot of blood in there, your chances of finding the source of bleeding are almost zero. So the only, you're not going to see anything. It won't help you decide whether it's the right side versus left side. The entire colon is going to look black, covered with blood.
Dr. Martin, would you do colonoscopy now, later, and ever?
Well, a couple things. First, I'd have to disagree with what Hassan just said. I mean, we say that, but the literature shows your yield is not close to zero with colonoscopy. There's a reasonable yield. You can lavage out that blood. So he didn't have anything done. He just got admitted to the ICU. You know, we used to have this discussion, should we scope him? Should we get the nuclear scan, and really we've gone to getting a CT angio early on these patients, and I can't remember the last time that didn't show us reliably what the source was. If our clinical
you cannot
suspicion,
remember the CT angio not showing the site of bleeding,
we basically triage them as they're clearly not bleeding. We'll admit them and then get them ready for endoscopy. They have clear signs they're actively bleeding. We'll get a CT angio, and I can't remember the last one that didn't give us good evidence of where.
So I mean, Martin, we agree on this thing. I mean, I would, instead of doing an emergent colonoscopy, I would do a CTA, and keep the patient resuscitated, and then do some directed investigation after that.
So what if these patients a lot of times are in AKI, right? They come in, they're bleeding, they're in shock.
He's a young guy.
He's very young.
So
he's
young.
Very young. But what if his creatinine is, you know, like 1.5,
but he's retired.
1.8, whatever. Like, would you do it that night? You would be okay with that.
Got to do it to save his life.
We did a colonoscopy.
There you go.
After 2 hours, after, you know, most of the blood passed and there was a lot of blood in the colon, as Dr. Alam wisely predicted, there was a lot of blood in the colon. They said a possible angiodysplasia. You see, this is the picture of the angiodysplasia, and in bleeding patients, you rarely see that. So it wasn't this. It wasn't that. They saw something here, and they applied clips, and, you know, it was peaceful for about 12 hours.
Where was that in the colon, George?
It was in the transverse colon.
Transverse, perfect.
Yeah. And then, It was in the right colon. And then there was new bleeding, new hemodynamic instability, new blood resuscitation. The bleeding stopped again. Another colonoscopy was unable to determine. So for the next 24 hours, we played this game. There was some bleeding, but it wasn't dramatic. We gave some fluid resuscitation and blood, but nothing really dramatic. Yeah, not massive blood transfusion type of thing, nothing dramatic. The relatives of the patient were not very happy with us. Two colonoscopies now. We haven't found anything. The patient bled and stopped and re-bled and re-stopped and re-re-bled and re-re-stopped. So what should we do now, Dr. Salen?
So if those are the real scope pictures, I think you're still dealing with an unlocalized GI bleed. And at some point when he is bleeding a little bit, the CTA should be timed with his stability because you've
now worried about the CTA?
No.
That we order CTAs for patients at the time they bleed, but then we resuscitate them because they're bleeding. And then they come and like 3 hours later, eventually they get a CTA. And unless if you are in Dr. Martin's institution, you don't find things when things should be there?
I think you have to time it appropriately to catch bleeding, because obviously the CTA needs a certain amount of bleeding to be caught. But I think actually bleeding and having low blood pressures and low perfusion pressures is much more dangerous to the kidneys than the CTA load. And I think understanding and localizing the bleeding, stopping it, and getting a definitive plan for this person would be much more effective in terms of renal protective strategy.
Dr. Nera, you said that this patient is old, so you are afraid about renal toxicity. Are you? Would you do the CTA right now?
I think that these are obviously hard because he's like bleeding a little and then he stops and he bleeds a little and he stops. And so you're trying to, I totally agree with Dr. Salent that we haven't adequately localized the source. I wouldn't sort of assume it's what we've seen in the scope. And so your options are a CTA or a nuclear medicine study, which is a little bit more sensitive for in terms of...
What would you do, a nuclear scintigraphy study or a CTA?
Well, I'm going to do something to localize, and it depends a little bit on how much he's bleeding at the time. So either a CTA or a nuclear medicine study.
Okay. With this very decisive answer, Dr. Ye, would you do a scintigraphy or a CTA?
I would do a third option, which would be to provoke the bleeding.
You were going to say that. I knew it.
Yeah.
It was coming.
Well, I would ask. I would request our IR because there's another yeah. option. So it's
all
not
right.
just
order on the podium. Dr. Alam, what would you do?
I would do a CTA.
I
think the problem with the bleeding scan is it just shows you a blush, but you got no idea. It doesn't give you enough information to what part of the bowel you're going to take out. And what was missed in the first slide that George showed is 80% of them in the colon, 10% are in the upper GI tract, but about 15% are in the small bowel. So you don't want to be taking out the right colon. That was not a very convincing picture to
me. We were not in La Jolla, California, like Dr. Martin is, and we had a negative CTA. Negative CTA. That was where, you know, these clips were placed by colonoscopy. I mean, they weren't sure anyway, but I think confirmatively the right colic and the ileocolic artery are negative.
Yeah. Well, that's a regular angio, right? That's not a CTA. You did a CTA or you did a regular angio?
This is the angio.
Yeah. But he did a CTA first. Okay. Well, all our angiographers, I don't know how it is for you, but our angiographers, essentially, they do not do an angiogram unless if we do a CTA first, for good or for bad, that's the trend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I thought that I would give you like the most sensitive, you know, everything was negative. Transverse colon negative, right colon negative, IMA negative, celiac axis negative. We gave him 200 mLs of contrast and it was all negative.
See, this is why you do it early when he's bleeding.
Yes, I agree with you that there is something to be said about the timing of our interventions. And quite frankly, I do get, like Dr. Alam said, I do get the point by the gastroenterologist who almost never, most of them, never do an urgent colonoscopy as opposed to an urgent endoscopy. When you're bleeding from the upper GI system, then they are very happy to do the endoscopy urgently. But from the lower part, they are unhappy about doing that urgently. And I get their point about the placed full of blood and feces and not being able to visualize anything. But the CTAs and the angiograms, I still think that we're late with those. And if we are to see results, we have to do it right there when the patient bleeds. I don't know, Nick, Namayas, you're at University of Miami, like Dante. Do you guys have a way of doing CTAs immediately as the patient is bleeding, or it always a couple of hours before you do it?
Only for trauma. Everything else takes time.
Yeah. That's why we have to make everything else like trauma. So we did a capsule endoscopy.
Wow.
That was negative. We didn't have any further problems, we smoothened the relationship. We kept our hopes high that finally this patient stopped. Now, 24 hours later, these are unnerving 24 hours. We count them by the hour because he has bled already three times, and three times we failed to find the source.
Let me guess, and he bleeds again.
Yeah. You got it. Yeah. So he bled again. So now what?
No.
Now what,
so, Dr. George, Mark? Had you done an upper endoscopy yet at this point? Because all you said so far is
lower. We had placed an NG tube and there was no blood in the stump.
Oh, well, we would have done an upper endoscopy as soon as he re-bled, too.
We did an upper endoscopy, too, and it was negative.
Okay.
And you prepped him and did a colonoscopy.
And what?
You prepped him and did a good colonoscopy.
Yes, yes. And we had two colonoscopies. The second one was particularly satisfying, and there was nothing really found, nothing major found, except of this little dot, you know, in some blood on the right colon, and they threw some clips.
I can bet he's not bleeding from his colon. He's bleeding from a small bowel.
How much you want to bet?
I'll bet you a beer.
Okay. All right. I feel thirsty.
Does he have diverticuli? That's something.
Yeah, he had some diverticuli. Nothing, no blood coming from any orifice. What would you do now?
How much is he bleeding?
How much is he bleeding?
He
dropped his hematocrit down to 7. Yeah. His hemoglobin.
So I would provoke him at this point.
Huh?
I would provoke him at this
point. Okay, can you explain what you mean you would provoke him?
Yeah. So I would do another angio, but if I didn't see a source of bleeding, which I quite probably won't, given the way this case is going, I would talk to IR about doing a provocative angio, which involves systemic anticoagulation, usually heparin, and then local catheter-directed thrombolytic and a vasodilator to try to see if, you know, there's all sorts of bleeding that you can actually make bleed so that you can then identify it and fix it.
Do you do at University of Michigan these crazy things?
No.
She wants to cause bleeding on a patient who's dying of bleeding.
Yeah. I mean, so I would never say anything negative about her. She was my resident. So I never, you will hear me say anything negative about her. But I just want to point this out to the audience. One is, it shouldn't be taken lightly because the patient may bleed in a massive fashion. So if you do it, a couple things, your blood bank has to be ready, an OR has to be ready, your team has to be ready. You have to hold the hand of the interventional radiology person who's doing it. And if you see a bleeding source, then you have to tell them to leave your catheter in place. So when you do go to the OR, because it's going to be in small bowel, so you can find the source of bleeding because you won't be able to see it in the OR when you open the belly up. So to leave the catheter in place.
Well,
totally agree with all those.
Yeah. So provocative angiogram, it is a provocative idea that when you run out of options, you can cause the bleeding in the hope that you will find it when you cause it. As it was very correctly pointed out, this is not something that you just order. Oh, by the way, don't you do a provocative angio? This is something that you plan very carefully. You have your operating room ready. You have the anesthesia team ready. You are with a patient ready to resuscitate, because on a bleeding patient who temporarily they're not finding the bleed, but he has proven to bleed, you will cause bleeding. And as it was mentioned again, you inject heparin systemically and the vasodilator, and then if everything else fails, you inject a thrombolytic. And this is what we did. And look at that. This is the right side of the colon. It starts showing. It shows better and better and better and better. And it's clearly where the bleeding is, and it was hiding with all the previous tests for so many days. And finally, that was embolized, and there was no bleeding at the conclusion of the procedure. So a few coils there that took care of the problem. Any problem, Dr. Ye, with these coils?
Yes, they can cause ischemia. So that's the downside of doing this.
Well, this is not this patient because that's small bowel, but these coils are possibly in a terminal branch, right? And depending on the collateral vascularization, they may cause ischemia.
Correct. Yeah.
So do after they embolize the terminal branch, do you routinely go in or do you routinely plan a diagnostic laparoscopy the next day or just rely on clinical exam? What do you do? Yes.
Oh, I don't think I've done enough of these to say I have a routine for all of them. I mean, these are pretty rare. You're pretty far out on that algorithm. But I mean, the times that I've done it, a handful of times, we just watch the patient clinically for the development of peritonitis.
There's radiology literature down on that. So, I mean, you know, they'll all be a little ischemic. I mean, that's why the bleeding stopped, right? But the question is whether there's enough collateral to keep it viable. So about the rate just commonly cited is 10, 15, 20%, which means that one out of five patients will have a full thickness ischemia, but 8 out of 10 or 7 out of 10 will not. They will have, you know, some ischemia, but not transmural, and they'll develop collateral and the bowel would live. So at least what you mandated is serial exam, close observation, white blood cell count, keep on poking at the belly and have a low threshold.
Dr. Martin.
Yeah, and I think it depends on location too. Stomach, I don't worry about. Small bowel, I worry about. That's the one you really got to watch closely.
Right colon, cecum.
Cecum, right colon, I don't worry that much about. That's a well-vascularized area. Watershed areas of the colon, I worry a little more about.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, I don't think that there is a consensus, but it seems to me that most of you would not do routine, would not book the patient for a diagnostic laparoscopy the next day. You would just follow very, very carefully. So he did fine, and everybody lived happily thereafter. The patient, the doctors, the wife, everybody was very... But if I can play a hypothetical scenario, and that's the last slide here, what if he had not stopped? Now you've done colonoscopies, you've done angios, you've done provocative angios, and he keeps on bleeding, and every time this patient with the two stents drops his hemoglobin down to 6, and the next time you're afraid that he's going to drop it down to 4 and die... And what surgical options would you have, maybe Dr. Salen?
Well, I think in this gentleman, it's, once he's localized, you could, if you continue to have issues there post-coiling, do the, you know, resection. Otherwise, I think you're stuck between a rock and a hard place because you don't want to take someone unnecessarily to surgery with an unlocalized GI bleed.
But if you, would you take him or would you not? This very patient who now following the provocative angio keeps on bleeding.
So I think you get stuck waiting for them to have a more significant bleed and then making, you know, and you...
He's got a hemoglobin of 6 on the next bleed and a blood pressure of 70.
Yes, if it's your fourth, fifth, and you've gone through every possible test, I think you owe him...
You would take him, and what would you do?
CTAs, what and would... then I think you're probably obligated, most likely, to do a total abdominal colectomy, which is going to stop 85% and have a really frank discussion.
A subtotal colectomy. Dr. Right. Alam, what would you do? Would you, number one, would you take him the OR, the case
yeah,
I presented?
I think if the patient is dying, you're obligated to do it, but I agree. I mean, you've got to have a very frank discussion and say, well, 15% of the chance I'll miss source, which is in small bowel, but if you miss it, it's 100% for that patient.
Can you tell me what you would do?
So I would take the colon out and accept a 15% failure rate in a dying patient.
Got it. Dr. Nara.
If he's totally unstable, I would take him to the OR. If he's not, obviously, I would try to do a push enteroscopy or something else. Your other option, I think, is also an on-table enteroscopy, is to make like a small bowel enterotomy if you think it's coming in the small bowel and scope him up and down while you're in the OR, if you're not sure it's coming from the colon.
So intraoperative enteroscopy. Right. Dr. Martin.
Yeah, I agree. So you mean if you haven't localized him? That's what you mean. Because if he was localized like you did to that little spot of the right colon, you could do a laparoscopic ileocecectomy and you're done. If you haven't localized him, then I agree with whatever.
No, you haven't localized it. I mean, you don't know. If this patient did not have a confirmative provocative angio, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah.
And now you've run out of all diagnostic options and you think of taking the patient to the OR, what do you do?
Yeah, so you take him to the OR, you look and see where most of the blood is, and if it's all in the colon and it's an emergent case, you do a subtotal colectomy.
Subtotal colectomy, Dr. Ye.
All right, so if we're just saying that it's completely not localized yet, you don't know if it's small bowel or colon.
Do you believe me or not?
No,
I think
I'm
lying?
I'm just saying that one thing I would consider, and I'd be curious to see what others in the room say, is to do a diagnostic ostomy. Right, so you don't know if it's colon or small bowel. You're there in the OR because you got to do
where?
Something. No, an endoleostomy. So no, I'm sorry, not an end. A loop. So you bring up a loop and you see, does the blood come out of the ostomy or does the blood come out of the rectum? Right. So you're there. You've done something. Now you're able to separate the two parts of the bowel and figure out, do I need to take out the colon or not? Because if the blood is pouring out of the ostomy, I think you can save this patient's colon, right?
Surgical options. So once you end up at this very, very unfortunate situation in which, you know, we all hope we will never be, but maybe once or twice or maybe three times in our lives we will, it will be nice, obviously, if you have a target, as Dr. Martin said, if you have a target, then ask your angiographers to tattoo the target, to keep the catheter in so that you can inject intraoperative methylene blue, because, you know, these very small catheters that they've navigated to very peripheral vessels, sometimes, particularly in the face of a thickened mesentery, it's not that easy to palpate. But if they can inject some methylene blue, you will see the bluish area there and you will have a target. But if you do a blind operation, a blind segmental resection is to be condemned. You have essentially three options. The one is the intraoperative enteroscopy, which was mentioned, and I actually tend to think, having done it, you know, a couple of times, that it's easier said than done. You make a hole. I personally put a purse ring around, but you contaminate everything because you inflate the small bowel, you know, and you have a hole in the small bowel, and you start running it, and you injure the mucosa. And some people can do it very well, but who has a lot of experience with that? So it is an option, nevertheless. Subtotal colectomy, I think that most would agree that is the major option. And temporizing ileostomy actually is not a bad idea on desperate cases. And thank you, Dante, for bringing it up. Because imagine if you take all the colon out, only to realize that the next day your patient is bleeding again. And now you know it goes in the small bowel. And therefore, this is one thing that you might think of doing. Just bring, maybe even laparoscopically, a loop ileostomy and see whether the next day the blood pours through the rectum, which means that you have to attack the colon blindly, or it comes from the ileostomy, in which case you know your problem is much bigger, somewhere in the feet and feet of small bowel. So these are the issues. So the conclusion, most lower GI bleeding stop spontaneously. Only 20% require intervention and only 5% require surgery. Do not forget the rectal exam and the nasogastric tube. It will occasionally save a life or take a life if you forget that. These are the diagnostic methods that we mentioned. Provocative angio is something that you should keep in your armamentarium for desperate cases. And if you need to operate, do not operate blindly, but consider either a temporary ileostomy or an enteroscopy or subtotal colectomy. This is where I think the teaching points from this case. And if you allow me, I will move to the next case, unless if you have a compelling comment.
Nope, you don't want to provoke his lawyer. His wife is okay, but not
all right.
His lawyer.
Okay, next case. This is a 50 years old male again. Epigastric pain from 3 days ago. The ultrasound shows gallbladder full of stones. The bilirubin is 8, the direct of 6, and the lipase is 2,000. This is a case that nearly everybody in this audience has seen again and again. As you see, I present not exotic cases, but cases that we'll see in our practices to see what we should do. Should you do an ERCP? Let me take you back to the patient. ERCP. Would you do an ERCP, Dr. Salen?
We have this debate every morning. Yes, I think in this gentleman, it's very clear he's got the appropriate clinical scenario with a gallbladder full of stones. His bilirubin is greater than 4, so he has a well over 80 to 90% chance of having a positive stone or something obstructive, and his lipase is elevated. And as long as I would certainly...
You would do an ERCP.
Absolutely.
Dr. Nara, at the Brigham, would you do an ERCP?
So obviously the benefit of an ERCP is that it could be therapeutic and not just diagnostic. But the problem is he already has a bit of a pancreatitis, and it certainly comes with some risks in terms of ERCP-related pancreatitis, et cetera. So most of the times, I mean, I agree that this guy probably has a higher likelihood of actually having something that needs to be intervened upon than some other patients that we see. But most of the times we'll start with an MRCP to make sure that he hasn't actually passed something while also, you know, trending his LFTs. And then an ERCP, if it seems like there's
okay, I will ask the other three, but I would be very much interested in the audience raising their hands. We listen to a very interesting dilemma. On one hand, Dr. Salen says, I would do an ERCP because the chances that I will find stones in this patient's is very high. On the other hand, Dr. Nara says, well, ERCP is not free of risk. And you know what, by the way, if I do an ERCP and I cause aggravation of pancreatitis, I won't even know that it was because of the intervention that I chose. It will not enter into any database because everybody will say on these patients, the patient had pancreatitis and that's natural progression. There's no way we can know whether it's the natural progression or the ERCP related. So these patients never enter into any database to have appropriate research and everything. So can I see a show of hands from the audience? How many of you would do an ERCP?
George, I think you need one more piece of information. What's the common duct size on the ultrasound?
The common duct size, okay. Keep that thought. who would do the ERCP? And who would do an MRCP? Oh my God, it's 50%, that's amazing. Okay.
There was a question from the audience about the white count.
Yeah, yep. So the white count was 14.73. So, predictor of cholecystitis, that's what you want to know, right? What are the chances that if you do a potential invasive exam? Yes, I'll take the question.
Can I ask another question? Who would do a common bile duct aspiration?
I'm sorry, what?
Who in the audience would do a common bile duct aspiration?
How many of the audience, is the question, would go straight to a common bile duct exploration? You can talk to the microphone.
The question would be that it would it be laparoscopic versus open?
A laparoscopic or open? Laparoscopic. Two.
At this time, you don't even know whether there's a stone in the common bile duct, so...
That would be, yeah.
Yeah, so, and he's got pancreatitis.
So you have to have a high degree of confidence
now.
To do it. And obviously, you're an expert, but I'm not sure that everybody in the audience is an expert in laparoscopic common bile duct exploration. Yes, please.
So I think it would be reasonable to wait. This patient's pancreatitis is probably mild at this point. He doesn't seem very sick. Wait for that to get better. In the meantime, you can trend the LFTs. You can always find it if he has a stone on IOC. So you don't have to do a preoperative ERCP if the patient's not sick.
Does it worry you that, please, you're on the microphone. Does it worry you that he has pancreatitis, which may be related to this stone? And therefore, if you wait for another 24 hours, he will go to reproring pancreatitis?
It's possible, but usually, you wait him out. They'll usually get better. If he gets worse, if he becomes unstable, you always have ERCP as an option at that point. The other thing is if you go to the OR once the pancreatitis has calmed down, you may actually do an IOC. You may find that there's no stones and you're done. If you're not comfortable doing bile duct aspiration, then you send him for a post-op ERCP.
Thank you. Yes?
Similar comment. I'd do a laparoscopic cholecystectomy earlier, doing the cholangiogram and having GI on backup for an immediate ERCP in the OR if possible.
You would do a laparoscopic cholecystectomy while the pancreatitis is in full effect and you don't know whether it's going becoming worse or better? I know that we would all do a laparoscopic cholecystectomy if tomorrow the lipase was 300 and the patient was much better. But in the middle of the pancreatitis attack, would you do a laparoscopic cholecystectomy?
Depends on the severity of the pancreatitis. Lipase alone is not the best predictor of the severity of pancreatitis.
I think it's coming up as an interesting debate that in a patient who doesn't have cholangitis, who's not in septic shock, I mean, all he has is mild tendon, his abdominal exam is relatively benign, there is really no downside to give him in 12, 24 hours, careful observation, IV fluids, see the course, let him declare himself, get another set of labs. If the bilirubin next one is 2, you would do something differently as opposed to if it's still 8. If the white count next one on antibiotics is 8 and exam is better, you would manage him differently.
Yeah.
Yes, Dr. Ye.
I mean, this is a night on call for general surgery, right? So we're assuming the sun has already gone down. If this patient is looking clinically stable and not have cholangitis, there's no way I would take this patient at whatever hospital I'm at. And I know GI is not going to be on backup for me, and I could get into some really nasty stuff right now. So unless, the patient is dying from cholangitis, no, I wouldn't take this patient.
Got it. Dr. Martin.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you need at least one more data point, and you'd want to see what the common duct size is. But he meets ACOG criteria for an ERCP, or you could repeat the labs, and if the T-billy now is going down to normal, then you could probably just proceed to a
very correct. Poly. Okay, these are very wise comments. I just wanted to place here the predictors of a stone in the common bile duct. These are the very strong predictors. These very strong predictors, when you have a very strong predictor, as Dr. Sailant mentioned, the chances that you'll have a stone is very high, 80 to 90%. And the indications of ERCP in acute biliary pancreatitis, the guidelines say either you have cholangitis or you have a persistent biliary obstruction, emphasis on persistent, and you all very correctly pointed out that you would like to see at least two measurements, clinical deterioration and stone detected in imaging. So this patient eventually received an ERCP with sphincterotomy in the stone, which is not very well seen here, extracted. And, you know, his pain became worse on hospital day two. This CT scan shows acute edematous pancreatitis, an angry pancreas. And on day three, he becomes very sick. He enters into the surgical intensive care unit. He requires a large volume of resuscitation. He's hypotensive, oliguric, intubated, peak inspiratory pressure of 40. The abdomen is distended, tight. What would you do, Dr. Martin?
So when was that CAT scan, though? So he's hospital day three now. Was that hospital day three?
I have another 5 minutes on this case. What would you do?
When was that CT scan?
Day one.
Was that right now?
Next,
when he's sick?
The day before.
So we would probably continue his resuscitation, repeat a CT scan, and see if he's developing necrotizing pancreatitis.
You're not worried this is abdominal compartment syndrome?
Hmm?
You're not worried this is abdominal compartment
syndrome? No, I am worried it's abdominal compartment
syndrome. So you're going to let it be?
Well, the thing is, you don't want to go into a necrotizing pancreatitis, even with evidence of organ failure, if you don't have to.
You don't want to treat the pancreas, but you're going to let him die of abdominal compartment syndrome.
No. I would have him intubated and paralyzed, and I would get another CAT scan and then make a decision based on that.
There are like five things you can do before operating on this patient.
Yeah.
What can you do? 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, so you can sedate him, you can paralyze him, you can do bedside ultrasound to see if there's any free fluid component that you can tap. I mean, all of those things you can do. You can use smaller tidal volumes that would take care of the inspiratory pressure, except a slightly higher PCO2 as long as it's within physiological limits. So I would do all of those things, and if they fail, yes, sure, I'll operate on the patient, but I won't just rush him and open
him
up.
So Dr. Nera, we did all these things, and the pressures remain 40. The patient is still on multi-organ failure, anuric now with peak inspiratory pressures in the 40. We take him to the OR, and we do a decompressive laparotomy, and we also see the whole retroperitoneum bulging, and, you know, with obvious necrotizing pancreatitis picture, what would you do?
At this point, I'm not going to be touching his retroperitoneum or his pancreas. I'm going to decompress him for his compartment syndrome and leave him open, but I'm going to,
You're not going to touch it?
I'm not going to touch it.
Okay, so that's very correct. And you know, in these few cases that will end up with abdominal compartment syndrome, you end up operating for abdominal compartment syndrome, and it would be a major mistake to go there in the retroperitoneum and try at the acute phase to do pancreatic debridement. So the patient improves slowly. We close his abdomen on hospital day 6, and then, you know, he lingers in the ICU and what have you, and on day 18, this is his CT scan. Big collection here, large collection there. We do an initial percutaneous drainage a few days later, and you see that there is, you know, some mild improvement, obviously because these are mixed collections, fluid and necrotic pancreas, and then we upsize the drains a few days later, and we are a little bit closer to resolution with smaller mass effects, but still, you know, a lot of issues there. And on the fifth week, the patient is still lingering. Would you do an open debridement? Would you do a video-assisted retroperitoneal debridement or endoscopic debridement? If I have quick comments, please, starting with you, Dr. Ye.
So I have no personal experience with VAR with VARDs. I do know some of my colleagues who would. I would refer to them. Also, I know some very good GI physicians who can do it endoscopic. But
I know everybody can do everything. What would you do?
if he's still lingering, me personally, I would just do the open debridement, and then depending on the approach will depend on what I find, like how the patient will allow me to approach it open. But I have no expertise in the
open.
Other two.
Open. Dr. Martin.
Yeah, I would do a VARD, providing there's no contraindication, and we have pretty good data. The outcomes are clearly better than open. What we're waiting on now is the data on whether endoscopic versus VARD is better or worse, but I would do a VARD.
Dr. Nera.
I would probably do a VARD, but I would think about if you had a really good window for an endoscopic necrosectomy, think about that, because then you have internal drainage that's established and you can get out the other drains even if you end up having to do a VARD sooner.
Dr. Alam.
So I didn't see any one of those scans with contrast. I don't know how much of the pancreas is alive or dead, but they're all non-con CT scan. There's no contrast in the aorta, the cava. I mean, I was looking at all of them. But if it's totally dead pancreas, then I would do a VARD.
Got it. And Dr. Salen?
Yeah, I think it all depends on how the necrosis develops. Is going to be whether or not you're going to do something internalized with an endoscopic axio stent, or you're going to do the VARD. I think the key thing is these drain placements. If you do them well, you can actually use them for the VARD planning, and that's key in the management, as well as getting the person buffed up, nutritionally replete beforehand.
Yeah, and to my mind, Matt, in the very appropriate question of, you know, what is better, endoscopic versus VARD, endoscopic usually needs repeated endoscopic treatments, which can be done even as outpatients, quite frankly, but I think that the location of the residual collection is key. If it's really behind the stomach, then that's great if it's right here. But if it's, you know, there and there and there and there away from the stomach, I think endoscopic is going to be difficult. Well,
and I would say not only that, but, you know, there's the ivory tower effect. So how many people in this audience are at a place where if you called your GI guy and said, hey, I want you to do a transgastric necrosectomy, they would say there's absolutely no way I'm doing that or I'm qualified to do that. Okay, so I would say most of us probably work at places where you don't have a Jedi Knight GI guy who's going to do that.
Yeah. I mean, even at the place where they never see a negative CTA, I mean, I was expecting a higher degree of expertise. So this is a stage VARD. You know, you see the routes that will be used across the drains from the right and from the left. And by the way, what about the gallbladder? This is an article that my colleague, Dr. Fagenholz, showed and proved that doing the gallbladder at that time is safe. And you see the postoperative imaging essentially after VARD. The collections have disappeared, and the patient was finally discharged, drains were removed, and he did really well. Okay, so the conclusions, teaching points about biliary pancreatitis gone wrong. I think the ERCP, only if there's cholangitis or bilis more than 4 with dilation of the common bile duct, no early pancreatic debridement, wait for 3 weeks minimum. And if you need to operate for abdominal compartment syndrome, just do this, the decompression. Do not touch the retroperitoneum. Start with minimally invasive techniques. And obviously, there are indications for endoscopic VARD and open. All right, let's move to one more case. And this is a 55 years old male. I apologize again, but these are true cases.
Old people.
old people, men. Yes. 3 days of left lower quadrant pain. This is a very run-of-the-mill case. Hemodynamically normal, white blood cell count high, left lower quadrant severe tenderness, but no diffuse peritonitis. This is the CAT scan. It's diverticulitis with this large abscess. You see this very large abscess here. No diffuse fluid. I would probably call it a Hinchey 2, right? We did the IR drainage, as I'm sure that you would all have done, right? Anybody else was thinking of anything else? No? Interventional radiology drainage. And after 3 days, he never really did better. And by the third day, he was febrile, tachycardic, hypotensive, diffusely tender, to ICU for resuscitation. You know, on a CT scan that was done urgently, the abscess was drained by about 50%, but now there was free air and free fluid all over the abdomen. What would you do, Dr. Alam?
I would take him to the operating room.
And?
I would do a laparotomy. If I can do a sigmoid resection, hook him back up and do a diverting loop ileostomy, that would be my preferred option. If I technically can't do it, too much swelling, too much mesenteric thickening, whatnot, then I would do a Hartman. I hate Hartman procedure, so I try not to do it. So if I could, I would do a resection, anastomosis, and diversion.
and a loop ileostomy.
Yeah. So if I'm doing a primary anastomosis, yes, there'll be a diverting loop ileostomy. Much easier to reverse it. Much less morbidity.
Okay, Dr. Saylor.
I agree. I think the one thing that to consider is I saw he was hypotensive, so if he has a high pressor requirement, I'm concerned, you know, in terms of ischemia or his perfusion, then I think that would maybe change to a Hartman's if he's particularly sick. But if you can do the primary anastomosis and diverting ileostomy, I think that's beneficial when you look at the patient's entire operative experience, not just including this particular operation, but also the potential for reversal, et cetera.
So I think that all three of you probably would go for the either primary anastomosis with loop ileostomy or Hartman, what have you, can debate that. Any of you remaining three would consider a laparoscopic lavage?
Absolutely not.
Nope.
Why not?
So the patient is unstable, right? The patient is hypotensive, is tachycardic, is not in a good physiologic state. So
is he the appropriate patient to do an extensive procedure then?
Right. So no, but that's not somebody that I want to be insufflating and doing laparoscopic surgery on either. But as far as I'm aware, all of the randomized trials have not shown any benefit for laparoscopic lavage in even lesser perforated cases. Now, this is a failure already. So it wouldn't even come into my radar to do a laparoscopic lavage.
Dr. Martin?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's a subset of patients that are okay for a laparoscopic lavage.
Who are they?
And that's usually a patient like this, and they have an abscess or a collection that IR can't get to. That's the patient I think it's reasonable to do a laparoscopic lavage and put a drain in. But like Dante said, the studies have shown generally no benefit, and one or two of them have shown worse outcomes.
I mean, I think the laparoscopic lavage is something looking for the right patient population. And I think there's nothing more fruitless than efficiently doing a procedure that's not indicated in the first place. So, and then it turns into a dog and pony show, and then doing laparoscopy, putting drains, then drains are not draining anything, then you're putting percutaneous drains. If the patient is not sick, then you can play around, upsize the drain, put additional drains. If the patient is sick, just do source control.
Dr. Nara?
I totally agree. I think that the problem with a lot of those studies on the laparoscopic lavage is that we probably wouldn't have done anything to those patients,
yeah.
Or at least
other
a decent, correct, other than a percutaneous drain.
You know, the day opened yesterday, the first day of, you know, of all the full sessions of the college. In this very room, it was amazing, I must say. Every single chair was taken, and all the space behind was taken by standing room only, and they were discussing, all the experts, about the management of diverticulitis, specifically one of the points of discussion about the value of laparoscopic lavage. Does any of you have any thoughts about laparoscopic lavage on this patient? You would do laparoscopic lavage? Could you approach the microphone and tell us why?
So while he's coming up, I think the patient with Hinchey 3, you know, purulent peritonitis, and you're going in and you're washing out, and you're actually accomplishing something, and then leaving a drain, that's probably reasonable.
He's Hinchey 3. That's what he's, let's say.
He was Hinchey
3. Oh, he can be 4, of course, but yes.
Yeah. Okay, so I know it's you're looking at me. I'm from Europe, so obviously.
Which country?
I was trained in France and working in Greece. So
so you represent two countries.
Yes. Now, the question is, as you're saying, that laparoscopic lavage could be used for a very specific subpopulation of patients. The fact that he's severely sick does not negate the indication to have a laparoscopic exploration that could answer the question if it's a Hinchey 3 or Hinchey 4. And secondarily, it's a procedure that can be really fast. I agree that all research papers have not shown any benefit, but they do tend to have a better reverse, they fare better on the aspect of stoma. Every patient that we operate, and we're talking about non-specialized colorectal surgeons, we're not talking about somebody that can do a resection or even a Hartman procedure, which would be extremely difficult in this case.
Right.
So we will end up with a procedure that most probably cannot be managed by a non-colorectal surgeon, and we'll end up in a stoma that will be very difficult to reverse afterwards. So this is why I would think of doing an exploratory laparoscopy. And if it were indeed a HINSEE 3 without any major contamination, I would think about laparoscopic lavage.
Thank you. Next comment.
Di Heffernan from Providence, Rhode Island, but I also represent Dublin, Ireland, which is where I originally trained. And so I think one of the things that most Americans don't quite understand is some of the limited resources in some of the major studies. So one of the first studies was actually at Cork in Ireland, and that's the one that keeps getting quoted over and over and over and over again, particularly at our place. And Paul Revan, who did this, really wanted to make the point that we have these great panels, you have all these facilities and resources, but many, many places, interventional radiology is not available. And so the reason the study came about in the first place, one of the first ones, Cork, Ireland, was because this was the surgical equivalent to VIR. So before the panel is very dismissive of this thing, you've got to recognize you got these sick patients, and if you look at the patient population in that paper, it was very sick, elderly patients who could not tolerate general anesthesia. They had sedation, heavy sedation, small incisions with low insufflation, 10 millimeters of mercury instead of the 15, enough to just get a port in there, place a big drain, and get out.
As always, so it's the details that matter, right?
Right. So, yeah. So one of the original papers was the surgical interventional radiology, and it's not what you guys consider to be this laparoscopy, big insufflation to our case. So just be aware of the papers.
Thank you very much. Very good comment. Dr. Di Saverio from Bologna, now from Cambridge.
Yeah, I represent two countries. I've been one of the investigators of the ladies' trial, and I moved away now from laparoscopic lavage. Furthermore, I disagree with my European colleague. I think this patient is...
Well, you're in England now, so
borderline.
Is it Europe?
It's borderline unstable.
I mean, yeah. You don't care about Europe anyway now.
It's, Brexit. It's borderline unstable. It's not a good candidate for laparoscopic approach. And furthermore, if you go in, you already had a failed percutaneous drain. Even if you are an expert minimally invasive surgeon, an expert colorectal surgeon, you really... You will struggle to get anything, even to get away from the operation, and clearly also is probably in G4 because he has failed. So now he's got free air. There is
so what would you do, Solomon, on this case?
Open heart, man. Open. This patient needs to go home.
Yes, comment back there.
For me?
Yes.
Thank you. Mauro Zago, Italy.
Mario, yes, yes, yes.
A question to the panel. Why not to leave the abdomen open? So the patient was very sick. Why not to resect, to leave the stumps there, coming back 2 days after, and if the patient recover, physiological recover, you can do a direct anastomosis without any stoma.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, to be honest, because I proposed that to do the hook up the bowel and do the proximal diversion. 2 days later, I would still not do a one-stage operation. So, again, think about it from a practical standpoint.
We have about 1 minute.
Yeah. Well, you know, I would not leave the abdomen open. So, I mean, just to paraphrase Teddy Roosevelt, he said, in a moment of decision, the best thing is to do the right thing, the next best is to do the wrong thing, and the worst is to do nothing. So, you know, if that's all you can do, fine. I mean, the patient is dying on you, leaving the belly open makes sense, but just to leave it open for the sake of leaving it open, I won't.
Yeah, and the literature on the fate of those anastomoses that you do after a damage control procedure, even though they're stabilized and you're kind of assuming like it's just like an upfront anastomosis, the leak rate, minimum leak rates are 15 to 20%. So it's still a pretty significant leak rate.
Yeah. So Hartmann's versus laparoscopic lavage, and obviously primary anastomosis with loop ileostomy. But as you've heard multiple times, and it shows you that a randomized controlled trial is not the end of it, because look what's happening. I mean, the Lola part of the ladies' trial, which was comparing these two techniques with 90 patients, and they never did laparoscopy to confirm whether it was HINSEE 3 or 4, because apparently on HINSEE 4, laparoscopic lavage is not an option. It's only for HINSEE 3. There was no difference, and they terminated the study early because there were too many complications in the laparoscopic lavage group. In the SCANDIV trial, which was also a randomized controlled trial with twice the amount of patients, and they excluded HINSEE 4 reliably, the lavage was worse. And then on the third trial, the Delilah's trial, you know, from 2016, the initial results show no difference, but the later results found that the lavage is better. So that's great. We have one randomized that says that there's no difference, one that is worse and one that is better. And even if you look at the randomized trial, the meta-analysis of the randomized trials, you'll run yourself crazy because some of the meta-analysis, meta-analyzing the exact same results, they conclude that lavage is useless or lavage is useful. Last comment.
Quick question, because we debated this at my residency program. I'm from Phoenix, Arizona, so I'd like to hear from the panel. The idea between doing the between doing the Hartmann's and then doing the anastomosis with the ileostomy, the loop ileostomy, does it change your management if your patient has a colon full of stool, a column proximal? That do you do an on-table lavage? Does that concern you for your low colorectal anastomosis in that situation?
Would one of you only answer this question? Who would take
sure.
it up?
So the answer is, if you have a large column of stool that's going to be above your anastomosis, yeah, I would do an on-table lavage. And I think the one of the big attractive things of lap lavage was that you can avoid a Hartmann's, right? Because a Hartmann's is a bad procedure. But we now know from the data, most patients don't need a Hartmann's. Most patients, you should be hooking up with a proximal diverting loop ileostomy. So the lavage now becomes less attractive in that setting.
So this patient, for whatever reason, received a Hartmann's. He was discharged 5 days later, and there was an uneventful closure colostomy 5 months later. So I have another case, but I'm not going to do it because we're already over time.
What?
I thank everybody.
Sure.
Do we?
5:45.
Oh, no. Then I don't have enough cases. All right. Let's go to...
Am I right? Right? 5:45. Right?
Yeah, let's go back to the gallbladder.
Let's go to this next case very slow. So we were consulted on a 58-year-old patient.
Question.
Yes, please. Please. You can make a comment... for at least 10 minutes.
Okay, big comment. Back to the Hartmann's versus primary anastomosis and proximal ileostomy. Can you explain more what you mean by the column of stool for an on-table, why you would or would not do an on-table lavage? But also, are you considering operative time? Is there going to be a difference in operative time between Hartmann's primary anastomosis, ileostomy? It seems like that would be longer, and so would you take into consideration the condition of the patient at that time, and how would that affect whether you do a Hartmann's? A lot of questions there. Tried to make it 10 minutes,
yes.
if possible.
Yes, it's definitely longer to hook them up than to do a Hartmann's, so you do take in the patient's status into account. And again, the patient who's unstable, pressure requirement, transfusion, et cetera, that will be a patient you're either going to do a Hartmann's or you're going to damage control.
So I think a lot of times, and I say it not to sort of point fingers, but if you go in with a mindset that I'm going to do an abbreviated operation or I'm going to do just damage control, leave things open, you'll find some justification. Or the patient was on a tiny bit of levofed or, you know, whatever, you'll find something. The reality is that days of ether anesthesia are over. You know, you can do a safe operation. You can continue to resuscitate patient in the operating room with the anesthesiologist at the head of the table. So you don't have to do a suboptimal operation just to save 30 minutes. Now, if the patient is truly honest to God dying, that's a different thing. You know, but as long as you can deliver good care, you should be able to do a good operation in one go and save the patient another visit to the OR. And by the way, I don't think I've ever done an on-table lavage for the stool. I think colon loves stool.
Yes.
Yeah. How feasible or how frequent from your experience that you could do the primary anastomosis and loop ileostomy in such a situation?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the question.
How easy to do the primary anastomosis and the diverting opposed to Hartmann?
How easy is primary anastomosis in these cases?
It's tough on the first operation, and it's really tough when you do come back for colostomy reversal. So, and I do limited resection. I don't want to go all the way down deep into the rectum. So, you know, if you can resect it, you're looking at two healthy ends of bowel. The mesentery is not foreshortened. It comes together. I would hook it back up and divert it proximally.
Dr. Small, you are a prominent surgeon in a community hospital. Could you approach the microphone and tell us what would you do? representing our community surgeons, the real heroes, not the academic surgeons who live in ivory towers.
In this case, probably because of time and being able to get assistance in the OR, I'm probably doing a Hartman's.
You do a Hartman's. Yes.
So if you have a perforation, distal sigmoid, and there isn't a lot of soiling, do you leave the, you know, half of the sigmoid colon in and anastomose mid-descending colon to sigmoid, or do you remove the entire high-pressure zone and go to rectum? Because it is a different operation. When I'm there 2 o'clock in the morning with a PA, I'm doing a Hartman's. I would love to do an anastomosis, but I'm doing a Hartman's.
Yeah. It all depends on the environment and the resources and the support and the expertise. Absolutely, we cannot.
I think from doing mostly Hartman now, I think my 80% of the time I hook things back up with an ileostomy, and there's certain times when you just anatomically can't do it. And as I've aged, I've done smaller and smaller resections too. It used to be there was a, you know, head to sort of, you know, all the way down to the rectum, all the way up to the descending colon, and then you realize, as long as it's well vascularized, and you know, it doesn't, you know, you don't have to be a hero and take everything out. It's not a cancer operation.
But you don't want to leave a significant segment of sigmoid in. That, what I would say, would be suboptimal.
Yeah, and I think the other thing to consider is whether this patient's ever going to get reversed, and just thinking about that, because we're affiliated with the Dana-Farber. Everyone's got metastatic cancer and is on, like, chemotherapeutics, and so a Hartman is a better operation for some of those patients who are never going to get reversed.
If the patient is going to get a permanent stoma, then having a colostomy is much better than an ileostomy.
On the flip side, I actually think when you do this as the first operation, you're actually having patients that are much more advanced in age. I did this on an 80-something-year-old a couple weeks ago on call in the middle of the night. She had nice anatomy. And that would have been a woman that I think would have been unfavorable because she had such a long post-op course and kind of failure to thrive and was, you know, 85 pounds soaking wet. And she did great. She healed. She's out of the hospital. And now she'll probably get a reversal. If we had done the Hartman's on that woman, I don't think she ever would have.
Yes, please. One last comment.
I mean, the one thing I would caution about that patient, 85 years old, is going to do poorly, I think, with a high-output ileostomy. And I think, as they mentioned, no one's ever died of a well-formed colostomy. But an 85-year-old who's already 85 pounds soaking wet, that'd be someone that I'd worry about when they're putting out a liter and a half, 2 liters a day out of their stoma, and then they go to AKI. And so that's something that I take into consideration, is what's their baseline physiology, and how well can they handle that high-output ileostomy.
Yeah, excellent. And I agree with that completely, and I used to be a lot more worried about it, but I find that they actually, most patients do okay with the ileostomy, and it hasn't been any point that I felt that they were, you know, under volume or whatnot from it, even in slightly older, slightly sicker patient population, which is the new norm for ACS.
But question, I mean, you know, if you're doing a diverting loop ileostomy for someone, and you're not planning on going back in, it's the minute that they start to show a problem, like, what's to stop you from just reversing it that a couple days later? Like, you don't have to wait 6 weeks or 3 months or whatever.
I would like to poll the audience, because these are three valid solutions. I will give you three choices. The one is primary anastomosis and loop protective ileostomy. Number two is Hartman's. Number three is laparoscopic lavage. Let's start with a primary anastomosis and a protective loop ileostomy. Who would do that? And who would do a Hartman? Equally as many. And who would do a laparoscopic lavage? Okay, 3-1 needs the floor.
I just have one comment of the primary anastomosis. You need to take all the diverticulosis disease, or at least what it's, you know, like, you need. Most of the time you need to mobilize the splenic flexure. What's different between patients in the community, which I'm working right now, and the big academic center where I did my training, that this patient is belong to you in the private practice, and if they come back with another diverticulitis, it's going to be a big problem. Versus, you know, if you do the other one later, I know it's difficult to beat, but I think both they are correct.
Excellent, excellent comment. So this is our final case on a 58 years old patient who is in the medical intensive care unit. And we, the acute care surgeons, were consulted. This patient suffers from alcoholic cirrhosis, and he had an acute hepatitis A attack. And he really went down the drain. Really went down the drain. When you see this patient, who, by the way, had 3 previous laparotomies of unknown origin. I'm sure that all of you that have Epic can also wonderfully find what happened to the patients in other hospitals when you dig through 3,000 pages of unnecessary information, but we couldn't on this patient. And he was, when you saw him, on multiple organ failure. He was intubated, enzymes were sky high, he was obviously on cardiovascular failure, he was almost anuric, and he was on hematologic failure. These were some of the numbers. He had a hemoglobin of 7, a platelet count of 60K, a creatinine of 8, a total bilirubin of 40, and an INR of 3. He was on renal dialysis. He had levofed of 12 and vasopressin of 0.04. He was in dire straits. His MELD score was 40. That gives him about this chance for mortality. Somehow, while he was intubated and on multiple organ failure and what have you, the medical ICU folks, who are so much superior, so far superior than the surgeons, did a good clinical exam, and they elicited pain on the right lower quadrant. And they very appropriately ordered a CT scan. And this CT scan showed this. And they called you. I will start from Dr. Martin. This is the cecum. I mean, there are no hidden things here. This is the cecum. This is, you know, air in the wall of the cecum, gas in the wall of the cecum. This is, you know, pericecal inflammation. That's what it is. Dr. Martin.
Yeah, I don't know what I'd do with that. I mean, that would be so. I'd look at the patient, I'd talk with the family, and I would not rush.
So he's
right
wasting
to the
time
OR.
Now. I'll talk to the patient. I'll talk to the family. He's thinking.
I would treat him with antibiotics.
He's thinking. Yeah. What are you going to do, Matt?
I would not.
I would not take him to the OR, at least initially. I would have a discussion.
That's what you would do, not what you would not.
Yeah.
Do.
So I would treat him with fluids and antibiotics and watch him.
Huh?
I would treat him with fluids and antibiotics and watch him.
You would watch him?
Yes.
With a dead colon?
Sure.
Oh, you don't know that. You don't know that colon's dead.
Tell me about it, Dante.
Oh, I'll tell you that less than a week ago, I operated on someone with cecal pneumatoma, totally normal. Like, so if there's no free air, portal venous gas, you know, what other stuff, or just this finding of cecal pneumatosis, even in a guy who's sick, I mean, he's sick for other reasons, but I would not operate on that CAT scan.
Deepika?
So I agree.
In that patient, 70%
of the time, I mean, pneumatosis is going to be not associated with ischemic bowel. Even portal venous gas, 30, 40% of the time, is going to be not associated with ischemic bowel. Those are the things we worry about. I think in this guy, it's really hard, right? Because you depend on your clinical exam, and it's extremely limited. I mean, he's on pressors.
Yeah, you can't have a clinical exam, no.
So, but I agree. I mean, his mortality with an operation is really high, obviously.
What is the mortality without an operation if that's dead?
Well, it's high, and that's why you're going to watch him closely. And if he's going in the wrong direction, I mean, you're going to have an honest conversation with his family about the risk. And
I am relying on the two remaining panelists to instill some wisdom. You know, a patient on two vasopressors on multiple organ failure with right lower quadrant pain, who, by the way, has gas. What would you do, Dr. Salen? Yes. I'll go to Dr. Namayas, but Dr. Salen.
So number one, is he examinable? Because you haven't told me he's tubed.
He's not very examinable unless if you're an internal medicine doctor, in which case you can elicit right.
And looking at his scan, I mean, I'm not seeing tons of ascites. I'm not seeing huge varices up and down the abdomen. And so I agree. I think
if you go up and down the abdomen, that's what you see.
Platelets are low.
You see gas in the cecum. No other gas anywhere else.
But I think if he's not particularly jumping off the table peritonitic, I would sit tight. I'm assuming he's on antibiotics probably 24 hours before already, if I know the MICU. But I would sit tight.
Dr. Namayas, can you please save me?
This patient, I didn't invent this saying, but I have to repeat it. Not everybody has to die with a scar.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah.
Agreed. I guess this was an applause of disapproval of me, indirectly. So nobody would operate on this patient.
Yeah, I'll tell you, we had a case.
A patient who is dying of multiple organ failure, who you know has cecal pneumatosis, who maybe his last chance of survival is to take the dead part out, you would just let him die.
Here's another thing.
Well, you're not going to transplant his liver at the same time, right? So you're not going to save him. So we had a case like this actually recently, a little bit different location, and finally we actually just did a colonoscopy. And if the mucosa looks fine, you're not taking him to the OR. He does not have full thickness necrosis.
Yeah, I mean, this patient, you can't do anything to make me operate on him right now. But even if I was to operate, I encourage people to read some of the work that Dr. Gretchen Schwartz has done about the best-case, worst-case scenario. And having a discussion with the patient family that even in the best-case scenario, this is the outcome. So you're not painting like the rosy picture. You know, best case scenario is that this patient has a single digit chance of survival. If a patient was to survive, would be incapacitated, on dialysis, multiple organ failure, tracheostomized, and say, you know, this is the best case. The worst case is this.
I ask you, would you not operate on him because he's got a 97% chance of mortality by the MELD score alone, and therefore you write him off?
No.
Do you not operate on him because you do not believe that he's got dead cecum?
Two different things. So it's not the, you know, everyone eventually dies. So death is fine. It's the most defined thing. Sometimes the cheapest, easiest, least painful thing is to die quickly. It is, even if this patient were to survive, what the course is and what we're going to put the patient through. And I think that's a very sobering discussion, and that's a discussion that we honestly must have before you operate in a high-risk patient. So it's not about dying. It's what if you were to live?
Okay. Deepika, are you not operating on him because you're not convinced he's got dead colon with gas in the cecal wall but nowhere else in the presence of two vasopressors, or because you say he's dead already? He doesn't need to die with a midline incision.
No, I'm concerned that he has dead bowel there. I'm not convinced yet, first of all. And secondly, I totally agree with Dr. Lam. I mean, these are the ones where you sit down with the family and you do that NISQIP surgical risk calculator and you show them as best as you can what sort of living would look like, and decide whether whether that's even something that the patient's okay with.
Dr. Ye.
So. Beyond the NISQIP, there's an emergency surgery score preoperative calculator, and I haven't calculated because I don't have it now, but I would guess that he falls into it where he's at 100% mortality rate, yeah. Right? So we are not forced to do futile interventions. You know what I mean?
We're protected. By the ACS calculator and another calculator that exists. The chances for mortality were 99.8%. Right. Yes.
A quick question, a quick statement. So my statement is that...
Can you speak a little louder?
I think, quick question, a quick statement. My statement is that the only role for the surgeon in this situation is to hammer the nails into the coffin even harder. I would not operate. The question, though, is, do you think that part of this discussion is led by the fact that these sort of cases now get reported and our outcomes are so watched so much? When I started training, God knows how many years ago, it was the heroic thing to go operate, confirm your diagnosis, and then tell the family it's definitely dead bowel. And nowadays it's seen as you did a wrong thing because our numbers are so high, and what the hell are you thinking? So is it the reportable nature of these cases that's sometimes driving the resistance to operate?
I don't think it matters whether he has dead bowel or not. He's not going to survive, you know, a meaningful survival from whether he's got dead bowel or not.
I mean, if I cared about the numbers game, then we are in the wrong business, really. I mean, we get the sickest of the sick patient, and honestly, I have to think about whether I can offer something reasonable to the patient, and is that something that patient would want? And an honest discussion, because the best case scenario of that 0.2%, if the patient lives, we are talking about a life-altering course over the next few miserable weeks or months the patient might
live. Dr. Salen, you had a
comment? Yeah, and if I can just say, I think a similar patient population that we see that potentially we would operate on with this same scan would be the cardiac surgical patient. They come in, they're on multiple pressors, they look sick, and yet we're still taking those high-risk patients.
Yes, both of you. Why don't you start?
I'm Joan Sancho from Barcelona,
yes.
Spain, another country. I'm fascinated by the use of scores. All of you cited a score. Can you tell me which is the magic number? 90 what? that you would operate and below what you will not operate. And if there is no reason, if there is no number, why we, I do too, cite scores so often?
That's a very valid point. I don't think that there's any particular score that you say above 88.5%, I don't operate. Who knows? But 99.8% is pretty bad.
Pretty damn. Yeah.
There is a commonly accepted definition for futility in medical care that. And so
what is the definition of
it? It's like if you have less than 1% expected survival, yeah, then that procedure or that intervention.
So 99%.
Yeah, that's considered futile. And yes, and so that's a waste of resources.
Yeah, yes. I had a question for the panel, David Soybell Hershey. So is there any possibility that the bilirubin of 40, the INR that's high and everything else is partially reversible because this person does have dead gut, inflammation? Is the liver failure in any way being driven by that extreme problem? If so, it changes the calculation. But if not, I think it's futile.
So that's why I was asking about the level of ascites and the level of varices and whatnot, because I think that there's something that's a little bit not comparable to what the MELD of 40 is. And everyone that is this sick with dead bowel will decompensate. So you don't want to say no to someone that, you know, in old speaking terms, is a child's A or even maybe a child's B, because their MELD is now 40 because they've decompensated, if you think that's related to the acute illness versus not. And I think that's a tough situation that hasn't been all that prospectively evaluated, the acute decompensation MELD, which we utilize all the time in transplant to get people transplanted, versus the compensated MELD, and you might argue that the physiologic reserve may be different in those two patient populations.
This is such a wise comment, because that's exactly what our medical intensivists were arguing. We say, you know, I don't want to tell you what we said first. Let's get one more comment.
Sorry, Vamsi Arabindi, a resident at the Baylor
Can College. You speak up, please?
Vamsi Arabindi, a resident at the Baylor College of Medicine. I just wanted to say, regarding the thought of numbers impacting our decisions, there's actually solid evidence that they absolutely do. In the New York State, when the cardiac surgery grading system was adopted, a reanalysis in 2003 by the Northwestern Kellogg School of Business found increased mortality rates among cardiac surgery patients, largely because patients were dying in the ICU instead of going to the OR for cardiac surgery. And so it's absolutely true that even though we like to think it doesn't affect us, in many cases, when you publicize these outcomes, it does affect many surgeons' decision-making.
Thank you.
May I say, don't you think it's ironic, though, that we all are trauma surgeons, and yet we open the chest for blunt arrests in front of us with less than 3% potential for getting them back, mm-hmm, and we commonly accept ED thoracotomy?
It is true, but it, you know, maybe one or two. But I tell you, we did the mortality score with three different calculators, and it was always above 99%. So, you know, this very nice MICU attending was trying to convince me that, you know, compensated MELD, this, that, the other, and this is what we said. about operating on this patient. So, 4 days later, you know, I wrote him off. We signed off.
Amazing thing is he's alive 4 days later, so it's not transmural ischemia.
Signed him off. We didn't. I assumed that he died that same night, as a matter of fact. But 4 days later, now he's a little bit more awake. He's still intubated, but off vasopressors. The hemoglobin is a little bit better. The platelets are much better. The creatinine is way better. The bilirubin is still bad, but very better. And the INR is normal. And this very nice MICU attending calls me back. She had a small smirk, you know, at the edge of her lips when she was talking to me. The white blood cell count went high, which seems that he was actually mounting an inflammatory response for all I cared. And he was clearly tender in the right lower quadrant now, as she had described 4 days ago, but now the patient was more awake and I could elicit this response. And she said, will you take him now?
Yes.
Okay. Let's start with Dr. Dr. Salem. No, Dr. Salem. I want the southern folks from Miami.
I would rescan him. Before I do anything else, I would CT scan him. And if I see any of the usual free air, whatever, then I would...
No, there was no free air, but there was still... let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that we did your crazy new CT scan, and there was still air in the cecum, in the wall of the cecum.
Hasn't changed?
No, it hasn't changed one bit.
I would just continue on the same treatment, antibiotics, and watch. He's got localized tenderness, right? But not
generalized.
Not generalized peritonitis. Yeah. I would not operate on my
Dr. Martin.
Yeah, I agree. I would repeat the CT and base it on that.
Dr. Nara.
I mean, if he had dead bowel, at least that first setting, it is not going to look the same on your repeat CT scan.
Correct. I mean, he didn't have dead bowel then, I don't think. Otherwise, he wouldn't have gotten better. And I think now I have a patient who's awake, who I can watch.
This guy is tender in the right lower quadrant. There is a reason why he's tender.
Yeah.
It's not that he's got, like, innocent air there and he's so happy.
I'm tender in my right lower quadrant right now. Doesn't mean I need an operation.
He's tender because he's woken up. And don't mess with the strategy that's working.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I second that.
We took him to the OR.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. There is another option.
Yes, sir.
When I was in residency, we had a patient exactly like this, and that was 30 years ago. My attending put a cecostomy tube in and basically drained that area. The patient got better. We took him back about 2 weeks later, removed the right colon, and brought out an ileostomy.
You know, I mean, the human species is a strange thing, and I can't claim to understand physiology to why people respond differently. I don't think that what you just said, which is a valid point, this would work because his cecum was like as dead as it can ever be. His cecum was dead from this very first CT scan, and why this patient, I think that the
now,
comment
George,
about...
You got to justify that you operated on him, right?
No.
We leave dead pancreas in, we leave dead gallbladders in,
he didn't have anything else.
Colon. Now it has to be the deadest of the dead cecum, and he was getting better.
Do you want to moderate and I'll sit there?
No, I mean, you know, you're making the slides, so you can put down anything that you want to put down,
okay.
Right?
Okay. What am I going to do with this phone? So it was very dead, and it was dead from the very first time, and the omentum had caked
it. That's like the worst cecum you've ever seen.
And
right?
As soon as we took the omentum out, you know, there was fecal spillage, and this was dead. This was dead, and quite frankly, to tell you the truth, I mean, this patient, the reason why we did not operate on him at the first stage is because we expect him to die no matter what. And like Nick said, he didn't need to die with a laparotomy. We were expecting him to die. Why he did not die, I don't know, but it was probably because he had some reversible liver thing, despite the fact that he had dead bowel. And we did a right hemicolectomy and an ileostomy. That was all done very well. And he went back to the ICU, and I know that we are approaching at the end of our session, so what do you think the outcome was?
He died.
Who thinks that this patient died? You know, you have a problem. You always give me 50-50% answers. Who thinks that this patient survived? Oh my God, it's 50-50. So this patient had a good and fast operation, and immediately after the operation, he went into profound septic shock and uncorrectable metabolic acidosis, and he died like a brick. I mean, in 24 hours, he was dead. And again, this is you know, intellectually very interesting, what should have been done for this patient, and if somebody would have done something different, I would love to hear. Maybe we can have one last comment.
I'd like to ask the panel, before the point where the patient had an operation, when he was getting better, you know, let's say you repeated the CT scan, it still looked the same. Would anybody consider a diagnostic laparoscopy to help you decide at that point whether cecum looks fine or it's dead and he needs an operation?
Would anybody consider laparoscopy? I tell you,
no.
Yeah.
No, I mean,
he had three previous operations. Huh?
Personally, I would have not operated this guy with three previous operations of unknown type. I would want, if I were to operate, I would do a quick, short operation where I can feel things, do it quickly, avoid pneumoperitoneum for a long period of time, long anesthesia. But I think the reason he was getting better, he had walled it off and he was trying to survive.
Yeah.
And then we stepped in.
Yeah. And then, so he died. And on that happy note, I would like to thank you all, thank the panel. They were wonderful. And thank you all for staying so late.